before we left, a little over 2 years ago, we had completed just the first couple of chapters of Matthew, which you all obviously completed, and now are about halfway through the fourth gospel, the gospel according to John. Tonight we've come to the 13th chapter of John, which begins a whole new section of the book. After the prologue, the first 12 chapters of John are dedicated to the public ministry of Jesus. His announcement under John the Baptist, the beginning of his ministry, which included the working of many miracles, encounters with notable people like the Samaritan woman at the well, or the man who was born blind, many sermons and incredible events in the life of Christ are all captured for us in these first 12 chapters. Now, I know this gets a little bit into, I think, question number two, but if you go back to chapter 12 and verse 1, you notice that chapter begins with 6 days before the Passover. This is Saturday before the final week, the Passover being Thursday. And the word Passover is used in different ways in the New Testament. Sometimes it refers to the whole week, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Sometimes just the night when the meal was conducted. Sometimes the meal itself. Sometimes the sacrifice. But here, John is using it specifically to refer to the evening when Jews from across the empire would come to Jerusalem, meet together in private individual homes, and observe the meal. So 6 days before that is Saturday. Now that's a bit tricky because when Jews count days, they include the current day. We don't do that. So if we wanted to talk about Saturday, we would say today's Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. That's 3 days from now. They'd say 4 days. They would include Wednesday. So Saturday is 6 days before Thursday in this situation. Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Now Jesus had been away from Judea for about 4 months after he raised Lazarus in chapter 11. So he comes back. It's Saturday. The Sabbath concludes at sunset. Saturday night now, and Mary, Martha, and Lazarus throw a big party because Jesus has finally come back to town. This is, of course, when Mary anoints the Lord. The next day is the beginning of the final week, the Passion Week. This is the triumphal entry recorded in all four accounts when Jesus rides into Jerusalem with the accolades of the masses. Of course, a lot of people were curious about Jesus and Lazarus. They'd been hearing rumors for months about this incredible miracle, but they hadn't been able to see Jesus. He'd been gone out of the area for months. So now is their opportunity not just to see Jesus, but to see Lazarus, who was with him, who had been widely reported to have been dead and then raised. So it's a ruckus affair with travelers there from all over the known world. The second portion of John chapter 12 is sort of John's summary of the ministry of Jesus. Now, after the triumphal entry in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we have the cursing of the fig tree and the cleansing of the temple. John skips those. He goes straight to Tuesday. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke record all kinds of stuff happening on Tuesday. Jesus is challenged for cleansing the temple the day before. He gives some parables. He is asked to weigh in on some controversies, like is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? What about this woman who was hypothetically married 7 times? Who will she be married to in the resurrection? Which commandment's the greatest of all the commandments? On and on, this goes all day long. John does give us something that the synoptics, the other three, don't. And that's these Greeks who want to come and interact with Jesus. And then the end of John 12 is sort of this summary of the whole public ministry of Jesus. And now in John's account, that's the end. The last sermon Jesus will ever give in public. And John 13, our chapter we're beginning tonight, picks up on Thursday. So John also doesn't include what Matthew and Mark include, which is Judas meeting with the enemies of Jesus. So that's all happened in the background, probably on Wednesday. And now we're on Thursday, and it's the evening, and this begins the second section of the fourth gospel, which is Jesus' private ministry to the disciples. It includes the events in the upper room, what we sometimes call the farewell discourse, which is only in John 14, 15, 16, the high priestly prayer in 17, and then John and the other three gospels come back together when we get to chapter 18, when Jesus and the disciples cross the brook Kidron in Gethsemane. We're now late Thursday night, going into early Friday morning, when Jesus is arrested, beginning the events that lead to the crucifixion, which starts at 9 o'clock in the morning on Friday, the third hour of the day. So this is a great and exciting and amazing time in the fourth gospel, and a wonderful event that we have to consider tonight when Jesus washed the feet of his disciples. So we've already read the passage. Bill has our first question tonight. Question number one, I know we jumped into some of these questions a little bit already, but this is for Bill. When are these events taking place? What amount of time has elapsed from chapters 12 and 3? And why is it added, this is a good question, that Jesus loved his own until the end at this particular time?
Well, as you said, part of this has been answered. When are these events taking place? Well, that'd be Passover week. And what amount of time has elapsed from chapter 12 to chapter 13? As you pointed out, chapter 12, verse 1 reads 6 days before the Passover. Chapter 12, verse 12 is the next day. So that's 5 days before the Passover. That triumphal entry is 5 days. So I'm taking a stab at this would be a 4-day elapse from 12 to 13. I don't know if that's right, but that's kind of where I'm at. Why is it added that Jesus loved his own until the end at this particular time? I think that phrase, the end, I think it's here speaking of Christ's love until the end. His love is going to be until the end. But there's much more included here. This is a divine kind of love. This isn't a human kind of love. This is a divine kind of love. A love unto perfection. A love to the uttermost. A love to completion. This is what I had. I had another. Yeah, unto perfection. A love unto perfection. And think about it. A love even for Judas. You know, Jesus had this love for Judas and still wanted Judas to do what was right. Now, why state this at this particular time? Well, in just a few hours, Jesus would be separated from his apostles, and he's not going to have an opportunity like this to engage his team and give them some final encouragements.
Very good. Yeah, these will literally be the last hours that he has with them before his arrest. Someone else, Lauren?
It also leads up into what you see in verses 33 through 35. Little children, I shall be with you a little while longer. You will seek me, and as I said to the Jews, where I'm going, you cannot come. So now I say to you, a new commandment I give you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this, they will all know that you're my disciples if you love one another. So before that command, he shows them that.
That's right. What that is. He models it. This is some commentators note that this whole scene is sort of like a living, an embodied parable. Jesus is demonstrating the very command he'll give, which Jesus often did. You think about how Jesus instructed when he gave the model prayer. Part of the model prayer was to pray, Lord, forgive us as we forgive those who trespass against us. And then what happens when Jesus goes to the cross? Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. So he's modeling it in combination with teaching it. Just one other thing about verse 1 here. In talking to Bart, I know that you all have already picked up on this, where it says, Jesus knew that the hour had come. Prior to chapter 12, Jesus says a number of times, my hour is not yet come, my time is not yet come. But once we get to the final week, my hour has come. So think about it this way. This is kind of what I thought about. It's easy to love when everything is calm and peaceful and everything's going okay. But when you're coming up to a tumultuous time, which Jesus is about to face, when he gets to the garden, he's going to pray so fervently, let this cup pass from me. He starts to sweat those great drops of blood. This is his time of testing, the most intense he's ever experienced. Yet even knowing that's about to happen, he's going to show love to his brethren in the midst of great trials. He's going to still show his love for these men who had spent the last three and a half years following him. You have a brother? Austin?
You know, I was thinking about this and about the timing, why John says what he says there at the end of verse 1. And I think possibly that, and also what he says in verse 3, and obviously we'll get into verse 3 later, but it's almost to me like this is a divinely set aside amount of time that Jesus has with his disciples, with only his disciples. He's got, the plans are already in motion for Judas. All that remains for him is that Jesus is going to identify Judas as the betrayer there in the upper room. But he has this moment in time, however many hours there are right now, to solely devote to his disciples. And of course, we receive the residual benefits. But I don't wonder if this is John looking back, reminiscing, if you will, a little bit on these events and seeing, oh, this moment in time was Jesus showing his love for his disciples. That's my thought.
Yeah, maybe 6 to 8 hours, right? If they gather in the upper room at sunset, we're talking 6 o'clock. He's arrested probably somewhere between midnight and 2 a.m. And then he has those 6 trials that lead up to Pilate giving the final death sentence probably around 6 a.m. when he's scourged by the Romans. So, you know, we're talking maybe 6 or 8 hours left. That's it. This certainly would have been a memorable time for John as he reflects on these events. Okay, let's move along to question number 2, and this is for Dennis. What supper were they eating, and what was instituted during the supper? What does it mean that the devil put it into the heart of Judas to betray him? Does this verse imply that Judas had lost his free will?
Okay, this was pretty tough for me. I'm going to guess maybe it was the Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, that meal. I'm not sure. And over here, it's not the Last Supper. I don't know what was really instituted there. But on the second part of it, what does it mean that the devil put into the heart of Judas to betray him? Judas had already opened up the door of his heart to satisfy his own greed for money. And Satan just pretty much came to that door, metaphorically speaking. That has already opened Judas's heart to help Judas for Satan's own purposes to do harm to the Lord. And had nothing to do with taking Judas's free will. Judas had surrendered his will to Satan, and Satan merely confirmed Judas's decision to not stand faithful for the Lord. So I don't know what the first part of this, someone else could have to.
Very good, thank you, yes. Yeah, I think this is actually the Passover meal. So I do think there's a little separation between verses 1 and 2. Right? In verse 1 it says it was just before the Passover that Jesus had this idea, that this awareness that his hour was coming. But when we get to verse 2, in fact my Bible has a paragraph break between verses 1 and 2. But I think verse 2 is when they then gathered together. So you can maybe think of this as, according to the synoptics, we don't know anything about Wednesday, what Jesus was doing. He has this huge day on Tuesday, long, long day that goes well in the night. And then Wednesday, the only thing that may have happened on Wednesday is when Judas goes. Well, of course, Jesus knew what was happening. So after Judas goes to make his deal, then I think John 13:1 sticks right in there. That's when Jesus knows for sure. Maybe he wasn't, I don't know. But this was the clincher. He knows now his hour's come. And so he's thinking about this maybe Wednesday evening, maybe all day Thursday. And he has this intense, you know, Luke's account when they come together, he says, I have desired to eat this Passover with you. And so he's been longing for this time, as Bill said, where it's just him and the 12. And now verse 2 is when they've come together in the evening. And so when we get down to like later in the chapter, when we have the announcement that Judas is the betrayer, we can slot that in with Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and we know they're eating the Passover when that happens. So there's some things, harmonizing the upper room is difficult when you're putting all 4 together. The chronology is not, you know, because this is not how Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John always wrote. Luke especially is all over with chronology. He likes to bracket things into themes. So I think the first thing that happens when they get to the upper room is actually recorded in Luke 22, 24 through 27. And this is when the disciples start bickering. So they get in there, and the first thing that happens, they start arguing with each other. And I think they're fighting over who gets to sit next to Jesus, the place of honor. So you can imagine these 12 guys, you know, just barking at each other. Maybe elbows are flying. They're shoving each other. And in that chaos of the upper room, when they're trying to get reclined, there's no chairs. They're just all lounging around the table. This would have been the customary pose. They would have just been lounging around a table on the floor, maybe some cushions, and they're shoving each other around. That's when Jesus goes and gets the towel in the bucket. And so I think that's the chronology. We slot Luke's Luke 24 through 27 in here, right before Jesus starts the washing. Bill.
Yeah, and I can't remember if it was H. Leo Bowles or Guy in Woods that I was reading from that suggested that this wasn't an actual Passover, because they were lounging. And when they actually ate the Passover feast, they were supposed to be on their feet ready to, it was as if they were getting being prepared to leave, as they did coming out of Egypt. So I thought that was an interesting wrinkle. I didn't really know how to resolve that, except maybe thinking that this might have been a type of Passover that Jesus needed to have with his apostles that wasn't quite in line with the others.
Yeah, I don't agree with that position. And this goes to a very long-standing issue with John and this event. Because, like I said, the chronology here is very tricky. And so a way that some of the older commentators would harmonize John with the synoptics here is to say John is talking about a separate event, a pre-Passover meal event. I don't think so. I don't think you need to do that. I do think this is the same event. It's the same event when, just in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus makes the announcement that there's a traitor in the midst. And you have the whole Jesus dipping in the sop and handing the bread to Judas. Because that's all going to come up later here in John. It fits right in with Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So the lounging thing, I think that the having your, you know, you had to have your belt on and your staff in your hand and all that, that was probably only for the first, I think that was only for the first Passover. I don't think that that was part of the Passover meal going forward, because in subsequent Passover accounts, in the Torah and in the Pentateuch, and even in the historical records, like during the days of Josiah, there's no mention of anything like that. Once they get to Jerusalem and establish the temple, the Passover is a much more kind of formalized event, where the essential elements of the Passover were the unleavened bread, the bitter herbs, and the lamb. And that you met, you know, with your household and things like that. So I'm not sure that they had the staff in hand and the belt on, except for the first, that was just unique for the first one, because they had to get out of Dodge, right? They had to get out of Egypt immediately. But it's not easy to slot John in with Matthew, Mark, and Luke here, I'll admit. There are several ways you could do it. And that's kind of one of the older ways where some of the older commentators would say, maybe this is a different meal. But it just doesn't seem to fit that well for me with that. Austin?
Lipscomb, this may be another take, you know, throw a third ring or a third hand into this ring, but the term there, after supper,
mm-hmm.
that is of great debate also mm-hmm. amongst commentators. And so it reads, after supper, of course, in our translation, he says, the Revised says, during supper. He thinks that the better translation would be supper being served ready to be eaten.
Yeah,
so,
which is sort of what the NIV does. It says the evening meal was in progress. Mm-hmm. In progress.
So kind of split the difference.
Yeah. Anyone else quickly on Judas? That was also part of the question here. Anyone else have any? I certainly don't think Judas ever lost free will. You know, Jesus has already had some interaction with Judas. Back in John 6, he calls him the devil. In John 12, we get sort of Judas' motivation is revealed, but he's revealed as the thief who's taking from the corporate money box, the little treasury that they held. So that's already, you know, I think the idea here that John wants us to know is that Judas isn't doing this alone. All the spiritual forces of wickedness are with Judas on this one. This is exactly what the devil wants, and Judas is playing right into that scheme. When Jesus is going to be arrested in Luke's account, I remember that it says that Jesus said, this is your time and the time of the power of darkness. That's what's going on here. Bart.
Yeah, perfect verse for that is in 2 Timothy 2, 25 and 26. So they may know the truth and they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him.
Mm-hmm.
To do as well. I think that perfectly describes Judas here. It's not that he's not an automaton being controlled by Satan, but he has fallen into the snare of Satan. He's been taken captive by Satan because he refused the truth.
Yep, without a doubt, that's exactly right. Okay, we've got to go to question number three. I've got to keep an eye on the clock for us. So, question number three. All right, so now we're getting into the main event here, starting in verse 3. And the question is, for verses 3 through 5, why did they wash feet in ancient times? Why was this a practice? How was the washing of feet performed? And how does verse 3 help us in determining the timing and purpose of Jesus performing this act of foot washing for the disciples? Grant?
So yeah, why did they wash their feet in ancient times? Certainly they didn't have the same kind of shoes that we have now today where they cover their feet, and so the feet would often get very dirty. Especially having animals throughout the city, walking around and taking care of their business, that the dirt around the city would not be very clean at all. And so that would be the dirtiest part of the people as they walked and as they touched the earth. That was what touched the ground. And so it was to keep the house clean. Also, you had to have your feet clean when you're in the house, that you keep the house clean as well. And how was the washing of feet performed? I don't know exactly how it was performed, actually. I kind of picture it as maybe putting a towel perhaps underneath the feet and then having a basin of water and pouring it on the feet and then kind of softening it up with the towel around it and scrubbing out it that way. But I don't know exactly how it was done. It's kind of an assumption on my behalf there. And how does verse 3 help us determine the time and our purpose of Jesus' attempt of washing the disciples' feet? I'll go ahead and quickly reread verse 3. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God. Essentially, this is showing that, as was mentioned earlier, this is the last time that Jesus has with his disciples all in one setting. It's kind of like his deathbed wishes. He's there, having called everybody to him, that he wanted to make sure to say the last things that he wanted to say to them. The last thing that he wanted to teach them and show for them as an example. So.
Very good. But really, you know, too, it's sort of a strange contradiction, right? Which is like just the nature of Jesus. That the eternal creator of the universe could come in a body of flesh and die. Like, that's a contradiction. Here, it's God has given all authority. Jesus knows what's about to happen. And God has given them all authority. He put everything under him. He's given everything in his hands. And what does he do with that power? Does he, you know, destroy Judas and vanquish the power of darkness from the room? No, he performs this menial servant's task. It's just one of the, you know, incredible, maybe contradiction, not the best word, but one of the incredible mysteries of the person of Jesus, that you have this moment where he understands that it's like in the garden when he knows he can pray for the legions of angels to come and wipe everybody out. But he says, no, that's not the will of the Father. And he submits himself to their authority. Lauren?
Along those same lines, kind of gives you the sense of Jesus is given all authority. If you think about Philippians 2:8-12, you know, therefore God has highly talks about Jesus coming to this earth and lowering himself to become a man. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name, that every knee should bow of those in heaven and those on earth and of those under earth, and every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, the Lord the Father. So this is the time where he fills that and is given all authority.
Yeah, I mean, that's just, that Philippians 2 passage is the perfect text to put alongside this one. You know, taking the form of a servant, coming like this man, taking the form of a bond servant, and just an amazing incident. I just want to emphasize the true, you know, in the minds of the ancient Jews, how much of a menial task foot washing was. You remember way back in John 1, whenever you all were in John 1, you remember what John the Baptizer said about comparing himself to Jesus? He said, I'm not even worthy to untie a shoe. That's how lowly John was thinking of himself in terms of comparing him to Jesus. I'm not even worthy to loose his sandal. I'm not even worthy to touch his feet. That was the lowest thing John could think of to compare himself to Jesus. The most menial thing he could conjure in his mind was tying his shoe. So that's how the Jews thought of this practice. This was like not just servant's work, but the lowest ranked servant that lived in the house. Often this task would be given to children to do. And so it was a very demeaning thing to wash feet in the ancient world. and consider, for such a practice as what Jesus is going to do would have been absolutely unheard of for the master, the Lord and master, to do something like this.
Further verse, even going further back, would be in 1 Samuel chapter 25, verse 41, because Abigail offered to do that for David. She said, "Then she arose, bowed her face to the earth, and said, 'Here is your maidservant, a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord.'" Mm-hmm. Again, a humiliating, humbling task. Further expound upon there.
Very good. All right, we've got to go. Oh,
yeah.
So I found it really interesting that Jesus talks about how his yoke is easy, and then he uses the word girded the towel, and so he has put the yoke of servanthood on himself to show that he must do that. So not only is this the lowly of low tasks, but this is also, like, he says that my yoke is light, so the task isn't hard compared to what it would be to live without him, but he's still binding himself to servanthood.
Bill, do you have something quick? Okay. All right, we got to go on. Question number 4. So now we're getting into this exchange between Peter and Jesus. Peter questioning what Jesus is doing, then refusing to allow the Lord to perform this task, and Jesus responds to Peter. So why did Peter initially refuse, and what changed his mind, and what did Jesus mean in verse 10? Verse 10 is when Jesus said, "Those who have had a bath need only to wash their feet. Their whole body is clean, and you are clean, though not every one of you is clean." So we'll come around to the back over here to Trace.
Sure. So the first part of the question, why did Peter initially refuse to have his feet washed? So it's kind of confusing according to the verses here, because it's down in verse 8, where he says, "You shall never wash my feet." So it kind of makes me picture it as, I don't know how many other disciples' feet he's washed already, but mm-hmm. He's kind of going around the table to different disciples, and I kind of picture Peter kind of nervously watching him, it's Peter, so I kind of think of him like, it's kind of like a pride thing almost, but there's Peter where he stands up and he wants to look good in certain cases, like he says, he'll die with Christ before Christ goes to the cross, and so it's different. It's almost, to me, it's like a pride thing, like, you can never wash my feet, this is almost embarrassing. So he does that, but he does. I picture him kind of pulling away a little bit, pulling his feet away or whatever. And he refuses. And why did he change his mind? Well, Jesus makes it pretty clear that what I am doing to you, you do not understand now, but you will know after this. And then furthermore, he says, if I do not wash you, you have no part with me. So that's really what pushed the trigger there. That plucked at his heartstrings a little bit. And he's like, you can not only wash my feet, but basically my whole body. Because he wanted everything to do with Christ, just like all of those other apostles did. But it's a really touchy kind of a scene. And then there it says, explain the meaning of Jesus' statement in verse 10. And I think in verse 10, it's where it says, you are clean, but not all of you. I think that's the part that's the most troublesome. I think he's talking about Judas Iscariot there, obviously. Another good verse I had kind of to go with the Peter incident was Matthew 3:14. So it's where John is getting ready to baptize Jesus, and John's like, it's kind of like what you already talked about. I'm not worthy of loosing your sandal straps. Mm-hmm. John's like, you know, you should baptize me before I baptize you. But of course, yeah. I know how it goes.
McGregor wrote that, I caught this and loved it. Peter is humble enough to see the incongruity of Christ's actions, yet proud enough to dictate to his master. And I thought that was just perfect. You know, he recognized that what Jesus was doing was all backwards, that Jesus should not be doing this. But, you know, so that was maybe a little bit of humility, a little bit of understanding of the strangeness of what's going on. Yet he could sit there and say, don't you dare. Don't you dare wash my feet. You know, and that was just Peter. That was like classic Peter.
Let me throw this out real quick. John doesn't record it, but Matthew, Mark, and Luke do, that dispute. The wife of Zebedee, James and John go to Jesus. They want this notoriety, and this. And I found myself right here wondering, did Peter say, well, no, they'll just do my feet. You've done the feet of everybody. I want you to do my hands and my head, too.
Give me a little upstart, a little head up. Yeah.
Just a thought.
Maybe. Yeah, it'll be fine.
I thought your thoughts about Peter were very right, because you can see evidence of it in the earlier John, where Peter or Jesus says stuff to Peter about how he's going to die, and Jesus is going to be humbled, and Peter dictates and says, no, Lord, that's not going to happen. And so you can see Peter do stuff like that previous. And also, when Jesus appeared to this guy with Moses and Elijah, and he started setting up all these tabernacles. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's just like Peter loves to kind of tell everyone what to do a little bit.
Yes, he does. He's a bit bossy. Old Peter is a bit bossy, yeah. Anyone else on Bart?
Verse 10 to me is the hardest verse,
yes.
I think. And I like what D.A. Carson, I don't know if you followed him on this, but there's a textual variant.
Yeah.
And so, except his feet is not in the older versions. And so the verse can be translated, verse 10, he who is bathed does not need to wash. And the word bathe there is luo, it means a full immersion. And the word wash is dipto, to splash water on. And so Jesus is saying, he who is immersed does not need to have water splashed on him. And you are all clean, except for one of you. As Trace pointed out, that is Judas. They had all been immersed already in John's baptism. And so they had obeyed John's baptism, had their sins washed away, looking forward to Christ. And so Jesus is saying, you're all washed. You have been washed. But there is one who is guilty and is among you. So I thought that was fascinating. What do you think about the textual variant issue?
Yeah, I found that very interesting. And so and several other commentators are pointing out that there's a little bit of a play on words here between the bathe and the wash. And so the idea that I came away with this, and I read Carson's comments too, was that Jesus may be playing on this idea of washing in the sense that the 11 were all in, right? They had their faults, they made their mistakes, but they were all in with Jesus. They were bathed. They were in. Now, there were some things they needed some polish with. They still need a little washing. They needed to learn humility. They still didn't get that. They still didn't learn the lessons that Jesus had taught about the first to be last and the last to be first. The servant will be the leader in the new reign of the Messiah. They still need some washing. They still need some polish. But they were in. They were bathed. But not Judas. Judas was not all in. And Jesus recognizes the distinction here. So Judas may have needed a whole bath. He needed more than just a wash, but he didn't want to be clean. You know. And so what happened when Jesus came around to Judas? That's when I read this text, that's the part that's always, what happened? What was that interaction like? Did Judas say anything? Did you sit there silently, you know, and let Jesus wash his feet, knowing what he had just done hours before? That's the part of this that, you know, you just wonder what was in the mind of Judas while all this was happening. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. But for me, the baptism, John's baptism, you know, it suggests to me that at John's baptism, Judas didn't repent.
Mm.
Repent and be baptized by John. He didn't repent. He was still, even then, not a believer.
Yeah, could be. All right, we are way over on time, but you know what? I've been here for 2 years, so I have makeup time, a little extra time, okay? So let's get to verses 12 through 17, question number 5. Lauren, this one's for you. What was the point of Jesus washing the disciples' feet? And why might it be significant that Jesus washed all the disciples' feet, including Judas?
Well, the point is given in verse 14. It says, if then your Lord and teacher have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. So that's the point. They ought to do this kind of thing for one another. They ought to wash one another's feet. Metaphorically, they should do whatever necessary to help one another out wherever it is, whether it's demeaning or not. This was a demeaning task. It was lowly, or if it's a hard task, or if it's a task that's looked upon as honorable or dignified, they're supposed to do it. I mean, that's what the point of this was. In verse 17, it says, if you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. There's the why, or what is the point. Why might it be significant that Jesus washed all of the disciples' feet, including Judas? So let's focus in on Judas. Significant, even though the Jesus knew Judas would betray him, he washed his feet. It demonstrates forgiveness, or an attitude of not counting wrongs, as we see in Matthew 18:21-22, where it says, then Peter came to him and said, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to 7 times? Jesus said to him, I do not say to you up to 7 times, but up to 77 times. That's an example of this. It's also an example of what we call the golden rule, as in Matthew 7:12. Therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to him, for this is the law and the prophets.
Almost like saying to Judas, I haven't given up on you yet. Yeah. You know, I thought about this action and how Jesus infuses what, of course, was a physically necessary, as we discussed earlier, I think it was Grant. They're going to be grimy. They're going to be covered in dust from their, you know, probably their knees down, basically. And so there was a physically necessary component to foot washing. How Jesus sort of infuses a spiritual meaning to it for these men in this moment. And there are lots of things like that in the Bible. We always recognize at least two, baptism and the Lord's Supper, which are physical activities that the Scripture infuses with some spiritual significance. But there are more than that. You think about laying on of hands, which was a sign of ordination or of setting men aside for a specific work. Which we practice when we ordain elders, when we ordain deacons, is a physical activity that's imbued with spiritual significance. When Paul talks about the right hand of fellowship, right? It wasn't just a handshake. There was an awareness there that when the apostles gave Paul the right hand of fellowship, they were accepting him into their midst. Or even table fellowship, eating meals together in the ancient world, had significance. This is why they got mad at Jesus all the time. When he was eating with tax collectors and with sinners, it wasn't just that they were going out for a burger. That was his way of accepting them, and that's what everybody recognized. So that's why they got so upset. Maybe even in James 5, when elders are said to, sometimes in the ancient world, they would anoint people with oil when they would pray and ask for God for forgiveness. So there may have been an element in that activity where this was symbolic of spiritual cleansing that was happening. So I totally agree with Lauren that the message for these men is you have to do the work of the servant, whatever it takes, wherever that leads. Paul says, I become all things to all men, whatever is necessary for the work to be done and for people's needs to be met as best we can meet them. But those activities of service are sort of imbued with this spiritual significance that is not just you're helping someone who's elderly to clean their toilets because they can't bend over anymore. You're going over and cutting someone's grass or mowing someone's yard or cleaning someone's car. Whatever that task is in our modern setting, God has imbued those kinds of menial chores with this spiritual significance of service and love. And that is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And so the go out and do likewise, that's definitely the message here and a wonderful and meaningful message for us. Not just the, yeah, there's a job needs to be done. Sure, that's true enough. But when we do that, when we humble ourselves for others to take care of those needs that need to be taken care of, God sees a beauty in that, that Jesus is demonstrating here in this moment. Notice for the last question. All right, Malin. How can we carry out this principle in our Christian lives towards one another? Is Jesus commanding that we must wash each other's feet?
Yeah. I mean, as you kind of already talked about, there's several things we can do, but I mean, how can we carry out this principle? It's, you know, by putting others first and having that servant attitude and having the proper heart and mindset to be willing to do that, as well as putting it into action and being concerned about our brethren and those around us. So the second part is Jesus commanding that we must wash each other's feet. And as we've already talked about, you know, back then it was necessary to wash feet. And it was custom and needed. But nowadays with our automobiles and shoes and socks and everything, it's not as necessary as far as physically needing our feet washed like they did back then. But, you know, it's more of a spiritual action that we can take into play and, you know, help our maybe being humble, taking action to remove the dirt off someone's, maybe spiritually speaking. You know, I kind of need the dirt a lot of times represents sin. And of course, if you're clean, then you're sinless. And so maybe we can help somebody be sinless.
Okay.
Yeah,
well, I kind of see it as everybody in life takes their own path. And like the path that we can to make to heaven, you know, is through Jesus Christ, but it's the narrow path. And basically to help each other wash each other's feet would be like helping each other to wash our sin in a certain sense.
And after a week at the Shaw's, my car's in desperate need of a wash, so I'll be accepting volunteers at any time. Yeah, Bill.
Real quick, I don't want to miss this. Verse 17, if you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. So we all might know it's, hey, we need to be helping one another and do good deeds and all that. You got to do them.
Yeah. And the idea of having, you know, a wonderful blessing come into your life. I mean, Christians who are the most servant-oriented people that I've ever known are just the happiest people I've ever known, because they're not all caught up in their own space. They're focused on the needs of others, and they want to do whatever they can to meet those needs. And so while I agree with the spiritualizing of the text in helping people to overcome temptations and improve in their walk of righteousness and things like that, let's not forget that there is a practical component to this, a physically practical component, which are people have needs in this life that sometimes they need help with. And that there's a wonderful beauty in becoming a servant for people in any way that we find opportunity to do that. Austin.
Two things.
Now we're done.
Briefly. Sorry. But as far as whether Jesus is commanding us to wash each other's feet or not, some people take this as ceremonial washing or something. McGarvey made the point that he said, do as I have done unto you, as opposed to what we have there on the communion table, as he would later do in this same evening, do this in remembrance of me. So it's a similitude after I have done in whatever form that may take. And also, as far as the commanding portion of it, that should be a litmus test. Are we willing to wash each other's feet? You know, so many people have problems with sanitation. In fact, that was one of the reasons for multiple communion cups and things of that nature, because they weren't willing to drink after the brethren. They thought their brethren were too disgusting in some sense. So that litmus test again, are we willing to wash each other's dirty, disgusting feet? If you're not willing to do that, then does that mean you're too good for them? Does that mean you have some kind of an ego problem? To me, that's a very good litmus test Can we wash each other's feet? Get past that, whatever it is in our mind to do that. That will lead us to everything else.
We come to the end of our service and appreciate all of the input. We